Wake up! It's the Sleep Unplugged podcast with Dr. Chris Winner, episode 50. Is there a case for sleeping pills? I wanted to be wrong. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Sleep Unplugged podcast. So glad you could be with us. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you're a veteran of the Sleep Unplugged podcast family, welcome back. Great you could be here. This is going to be an interesting episode, and it really sort of came forward organically with a conversation I was having with another sleep doctor. And I thought, let's just sort of encapsulate this in glass. And when we come to the first episode of the month, and so this is the first episode of July coming, or I'm sorry, June, we've got going on now, we'll make that into its own episode because we really haven't spoken about sleeping pills since the beginning of the podcast, episode 11, and I think that's always something to go back to. So if you're familiar with the podcast, you know that the first episode of every month, we do a topic on insomnia. And I thought having sort of the debate, let's look to see if there is a reason we should be using sleeping pills. Is my view of sleeping pills too narrow or frankly wrong? And we'll get into that in the discussion today. Really had a lot of fun with the Sleeping Naked episode we did last week. We talked about in the episode, the National Sleep Foundation said that there were about a third of individuals sleeping naked. And we did some polls on Twitter and Instagram and found that exact number. Literally 34% of you that answered the poll said you slept naked, which is pretty close to a third. So really appreciate you participating in that. If you want to communicate with the show through Instagram and Twitter, it is Dr. Chris Winner is my handle. You can DM the show, comments, corrections, criticisms, whatever you got on your mind. We'll put some fun things up this week. Also coming up this week is the big sleep meeting in Indianapolis. So our next episode, we'll do what's new and exciting and surprising in the world of sleep research. So I'll bring you some dispatches from Indianapolis while I'm there. Maybe talk to some sleep experts and get some good information about what's hot in the field of sleep and sleep medicine. Maybe you'll hear it before you see it in the media. My books, The Sleep Solution, Why Your Sleep is Broken and How to Fix It, as well as The Rested Child, are available wherever books are found. We usually start the show with a comment, correction, criticism. I'm going to start with a compliment from friend of the show, Think Sleep. We've talked about her before, and she wrote a very nice review of the podcast and said, glad to have Dr. Chris Winner as a colleague in the field of sleep. This podcast is super easy to listen to and informative for anyone interested in sleep. As a behavioral sleep specialist, I love the emphasis he places on non-medication approaches to improving sleep. Both of his books are excellent resources, and I share them with patients often. So I wanted to share that just because, A, I really appreciate anyone who takes the time to leave a review of the podcast. It means a lot. When a colleague takes the time to leave a review of the podcast, it really means a lot. And I think her comment about, as a behavioral sleep specialist, I love the emphasis he places on non-medication approaches to improving sleep, is really the theme for the podcast today. Are doctors like me or individuals like Think Sleep in the right? And I think that deserves some exploration. Before we get going, the title of the podcast, I Wanted to Be Wrong, is a song off of the REM album Around the Sun, which was their 13th studio album. They only made two more after that. Rolling Stone declared Around the Sun to be, I think, 44th on the top 50 albums that were awful made by brilliant artists. So the top 50 albums that were truly awful but created by brilliant artists, this album found its way on there, which I think is a little bit unfair. But especially since the title track of the song Around the Sun, Leaving New York, is one of my favorite songs, period. It's just outstanding. So I've always wanted to feature REM on here, particularly since the name of the group, REM, now it's spelled R period E period M, is often thought to relate itself to REM sleep, but Bill DeMint, the famous sleep researcher, actually communicated with the band at some point, and they said, no, we named the band REM, but it had nothing to do with rapid eye movement sleep, which I always thought was kind of interesting. So REM, sort of the godfathers of alternative rock in the 80s, got their start in at the University of Georgia. You know, Dave Matthews is to the University of Virginia what I think that REM is to the University of Georgia. And so I wanted to be wrong, I think captures my spirit in this conversation, which is I don't want to be right really about sleeping pills. I would love for there to be sort of medications out there that truly did what they promised for our patients, but I'm not sure that this meets the mark, but we're going to find out. So how did this all start? So this all started with an interview I did for an article in Woman's World, which there's already clearly problems right off the bat that I'm being interviewed for a Woman's World article. But the title of the article was Make Your Beauty Sleep Count with These 9 Tips for a Good Night of High Quality Rest. It was written by the writer Catherine Drury Wagner, and you can find it. It was published May 10th, 2023. You can find it online again through Woman's World. And in that, there is the quotation that I stand behind that says, sleep specialist Christopher Winter, I should know that I was in trouble when somebody refers to me as Christopher. It's like my grandmother, Christopher. You know, there was a problem if somebody referring to me my full middle name. Sleep specialist Christopher Winter, MD, is even more blunt. Quote, I despise sleeping pills, end quote, he says. They cause far more problems than they solve, and the data behind their ability to improve sleep is virtually non-existent, end quote. So I put that up there and got the usual, thank you, this. But there was a conversation, and you can find it on my Twitter thread. It's not private. That a sleep specialist, Kimberly Mims, from the University of, I believe she's in Alabama. She went to University of Alabama Medical School, VCU for her residency. She was right down the road from me during residency when she was there. Duke for her fellowship. She's accredited by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology for both sleep and neurology. So this is serious credentials. She's every bit the expert, if not more than I am. In fact, we've talked about the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology board certifies sleep people as well as neurologists. And I let my sleep certification go not too long ago because I got tired of paying for it. So she's holds a certification that I no longer have elected to hold. So anyway, she is a qualified sleep expert. And we had a really great discussion about this. And she wrote back and said, look, I'm going to read the quotation here. And she said, don't get me wrong. CBT is always in the discussion, but refusing, and again, there's some typos here or something that, or abbreviations I don't recognize, but refusing essentially to treat insomnia with medications and expecting someone with severe insomnia to participate in CBT seem mutually exclusive. The inability to sleep inhibits the comprehension of CBT. So if you're a devotee of the show, you can probably guess what my first comment was. And it was essentially, look, insomnia is really not an inability to sleep. That's not what's going on here. And she said, look, yeah, I understand that. You know, I didn't mean to say that. I know how you feel about that comment. So she goes on to say, basically, look, that being said, I know CBT is the greatest all time for insomnia, and I apologize for inability to sleep, should have said difficulty sleeping, etc. My question is, what do we do for patients who lack resources, interest, or time for CBT? At what point is insisting on CBT in patients who have legit barriers to or no capacity for it, and avoiding meds, withholding adequate care? I think this is a fantastic thing to discuss. And it's fantastic for a couple of reasons. Number one, when we're talking about CBT, and we've spoken about CBT before. In fact, I think that it was the last episode. It was episode 33 of the podcast. The scientific results are in. CBTI is a cure for insomnia. I think everybody knows how I feel about CBTI. It is the way forward with people who have insomnia. So, Chris, are you certified in terms of administering CBTI? Well, it depends on how you define that, but there is a board certification for CBTI practitioners, and I do not possess it. So in other words, if you were a primary care doctor, sleep doctor, whatever, you're a clinician and you want to understand more about treating insomnia outside of medications, perhaps like Think Sleep, and we know, we've talked about her before. You can find her at Think Sleep on Instagram and Twitter. She's very versed in treating insomnia through these means. My nurse practitioner, Ellen Wurmter, sleep_NP, CBTI trained. So what exactly are we talking about here? And what does it mean to have means to it or not? And this is an interesting question. Because when I first read this from Dr. Mims, I thought, there isn't really a discussion. When somebody comes in and says, look, I'm having trouble sleeping, or I can't sleep, or I haven't slept in 10 years, or what's becoming more and more common, I used to get sleeping pill X from my doctor. They won't prescribe it for me anymore unless I talk to you. So here I am. Write me the prescription of the pill. I'll get out of your hair. I've got 30 minutes to talk to a patient. Now, maybe a clinician who's in a busier practice doesn't have that kind of time. You have 15 minutes, 10 minutes. This is not only a time I'm going to see the patient initially, but if I chose to write a sleeping agent for that patient, I'm going to see them, what, once every 4 months, 3 months, 6 months, yearly? I think most people who are writing for sleeping pills, just from a liability perspective, are going to insist that they see their patients face-to-face or through some sort of telehealth clinic on a pretty regular basis. In fact, some places are considering laws that, look, if you're going to write for controlled substances, which a lot of sleeping pills are, not all of them, but some of them are, that you need to see them face-to-face, at least initially. So we're talking not only about an initial visit to discuss this, you know, plan for getting somebody to sleep, but also an ongoing relationship. Even if you're just like, look, I'm going to write them sleeping pills, we're not doing CBT. So the patient comes, they've sat down. Hi, I'm Chris. Nice to meet you. Oh, yeah, well, Dr. Murray sent me here, and I've been on sleeping pill X for 5 years, and he's not really comfortable writing it for me anymore. Or he will, but he wants me to talk to you. Here I am. So even if you're not going to engage in some sort of really formal, lengthy CBTI practice, I guess my first question would be, what else are you going to talk about? In other words, every patient that comes to see me, I would imagine if you talk to Ellen, my nurse practitioner, if you talk to a lot of sleep doctors who do prescribe medications, if you're asking me, Chris, do you ever prescribe sleep aids? I have. Yes, I have. But everybody who comes to see me is going to get some degree of CBTI. It starts with, why? How can I help you? Well, I need the sleeping pill because without it, I can't sleep. The CBTI begins immediately after that comment because it's not a true one. Of course, you can sleep without a pill. It's exactly what Nicole said when she corrected herself. She said, you know, I'm worried about the people who can't sleep being able to participate in CBTI. And my comment was, your patients are already sleeping. That's not the issue. And she's like, I understand. They're not sleeping well, or they have insomnia, whatever, however you define it. So I'm not withholding anything from anybody. I have no problem in writing a medication for a patient, but I'm not doing it without educating a patient about what insomnia is. And if you're coming to my clinic thinking the only reason you can sleep is because you take that sleeping pill, I got a lot of evidence and a lot of opinion from people way smarter than I am that that is not true. And I think that's really important. I think that everybody who comes to see somebody for insomnia in some way or another is getting CBTI. Maybe the CBTI you're getting from me is like C minus level CBTI. The sleep information you're getting from Think Sleep or Jade Wu or Brandon Peters or all these other amazing people who've thought more about insomnia than I ever will, maybe that's A plus. But my guess is there's always going to be a conversation, and that conversation is ongoing. So even in the individuals for whom I would write a sleep aid, when they come back and see me in 3 months or 6 months to refill their medication, the conversation is going to continue. Do I think that we're going to cure people of their insomnia in one 15, 30 minute, 1 hour visit? No, that is not typically going to happen. But the education is going to start. The homework is going to start. The little seeds that we plant in their brains about the medications are absolutely going to start. So I get it. You know, you're lagging. What do we do for patients who lack resource, interest, or time? I they're in my clinic, so here we are, and you've got to come to get the medication. In terms of interest, that's pretty common. Most people who are coming in, it's sort of, they've already made up in their mind, I've been on this pill for years, I can't sleep without it. So they're not coming in like, hey, Chris, I'm really interested in your thoughts about insomnia. They're not interested in that at all. They just want the pill and they'll be on their way. To some degree, I don't really care about that. My job is to educate. It's not to preach. It's not to push my views on. It's to push science on you. So I made a comment on LinkedIn recently. I put a post up there and I said, basically, when you look at the data on sleeping pills, if somebody comes to my clinic and says, look, I'm really struggling. I need something to help me fall asleep 8 minutes faster. Okay, then I guess we're done. Well, I've got a couple of pills that'll do that based upon scientific evidence. That's what you need? Okay. But let's be honest. What are people looking for when they come to a clinic and they have insomnia? What are the stories they're telling us? You know, what does the typical patient look like? I've been going to bed around 11:30 and man, I'd really like to fall asleep closer to 11:22. Do you have anything for me? No. It's not that. It's I can't sleep. I wake up after sleeping for an hour. I'm up for the rest of the night. I go weeks and weeks and weeks and only sleep 1 hour. I mean, this is what we're hearing, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. If there's sleep doctors out there, Dr. Chris Winter, Twitter, Instagram, you can do it privately, anonymously, you can put it out in the public. And no, Chris, actually, we see a lot of patients who just want five more extra minutes of sleep. That's what they're looking for. They want to fall asleep about 7 minutes faster. This is not the individual that's rising through the ranks of the referral process and finally making it to our insomnia clinic. These are people who are struggling mightily and have very disruptive and harmful views about their sleep. So it is interesting. She said, you know, and I said to her, I'm not really getting a lot of people coming to my clinic who are basically saying, I want sleeping pills. We get those for sure. They're not the majority. I mean, you take out the sleep apnea patients, narcolepsy patients, hypersomnia patients, restless leg. I mean, they exist. I believe that most people are going to get their sleeping pill interaction probably handled at the primary care doctor level. I don't have a lot of people who say, look, I just bypassed my PCP and came right to you. I can't sleep. Give me a pill. Plenty of people who can't sleep. Not a lot of people saying, give me the pill. Maybe they're just not saying it. And it was interesting. She even mentioned at one point, do you think that, she wrote, I often wonder when I see other sleep doctors railing on sleep meds who never use them. Again, I'm not sure if they never use them, but maybe they don't. I do occasionally, but I wouldn't say never, but it's not my first choice. Am I seeing all these people asking for pills because they're coming to my clinic to get medications because nobody else will give it to them? I can't answer that question. You know, maybe people have just given up and gone to somebody else. And I tell patients all the time, look, if you want sedation, there's a doctor out there he'll give it to you, I'm sure. Is that what you want though? Or do you want a healthier relationship with sleep and your ability to get it, or a deeper understanding of what the problem might be. Meaning there are a lot of people out there taking sleeping pills who have an underlying sleep problem like sleep apnea that have no idea. They live alone. They wake up a lot during the night. They have no idea that the reason why they're waking up during the night is because they can't breathe. And they're asking for sleeping pills to help with that because they don't know. Oh, I didn't know the reason I was waking up over and over and over tonight was to catch my breath. I was just aware of being awake a lot during the night. And we've talked a lot about the perceptions of sleep on this podcast and how damaging and misleading that can be when you're just listening to a patient's description of how much he, she, they are sleeping. It's very, very difficult. So to me, I can't separate the CBT from the clinical visit. It's always going to be part of it. Education is always going to be part of that. So let's put that aside and think about what we're talking about when we give a patient sleeping pills. And so I've been struck by there's a newer class of sleep aids that we talk about that are orexin receptor antagonists. And we've talked about orexin in our narcolepsy episode. If you listen to episode 27, Narcolepsy, the Rare Disorder That Isn't, we talk about orexin. So if you think about orexin, it's a chemical in our brain that does lots of things cardiovascularly, endocrinologically, neurologically. One of the things it does, it stabilizes wakefulness. So if you're an individual who has narcolepsy, and we love our narcolepsy community on the Sleep Unplugged podcast, if you're somebody who has narcolepsy, you are deficient in orexin or maybe depleted of completely. You don't have a chemical that stabilizes wakefulness. So if we create a orexin wakefulness stabilizer antagonist, then we can create sleepiness. We're essentially, this is not true, but just as an analogy, we're creating narcolepsy. We're creating sleepiness. We're capitalizing on that deficiency or blocking that effect to make somebody sleepy. So it's a whole new class of medications. Great. And they've been around. In 2014, the first one, Belsomra, came out, suvorexant, FDA approved in 2014, based upon 3 double-blind placebo-controlled studies. And so when you're looking at it, go to the webpage. Don't take my word for it. Just go to the Belsomra webpage. A suvorexant and Belsomra, and there's a little place that says, you know, for clinicians, and you click on there and you can go and find the clinical data that this company is putting forward to you to prove that it works. In my search, it is very difficult to find any meaningful data on sleep latency, meaning does Belsomra suvorexant help individuals who take it fall asleep faster? I didn't see any on the webpage. It's like they kind of ignored it, because if you actually look at that data, it's not particularly robust. And we'll talk about that. So let's say it makes you fall asleep 7 minutes faster. That would be incredible. It may be giving a population over placebo maybe 30 minutes more sleep. So let's call it 30 minutes. You're getting 30 minutes more sleep on suvorexant Belsomra than you would without. The next one that came out was limberexant or Devigo. It was approved in 2019. It's a orexin 2, so it's a more selective orexin receptor antagonist. So when you looked at that data, and again, this is on their webpage, you can find it. Placebo took it took them 33.6 minutes to fall asleep in the placebo group. Given the placebo, they were now falling asleep in 20 minutes. So placebo improved your ability to fall asleep by a little over 13 minutes. At the maximum limberexant dose, you went from 33 minutes to fall asleep to 14 and a half. So essentially, this drug is making you fall asleep 5.5 minutes faster than a placebo. In terms of wakefulness after sleep onset, improved it maybe by about 25 minutes in some patient populations. If you're looking at patients reporting it in their own diary, 12 minutes more. So you're getting 12 to 25 minutes more sleep on these medications. Hey, that's pretty good. So again, what are patients asking for when they come to see us? Again, if it's somebody saying, look, I really struggle. I'm getting about 6.5 hours of sleep, Chris. I sometimes wake up, it takes me a little while to get back to sleep. I'd like to get closer to 7. I think I would feel better. Hey, maybe these are your drugs, right? So the newest one that's come out is QVIVIG. It's daridorexant. This is the drug that's got commercials with Lindsey Vonn and Taye Diggs and just what a, you know, sort of disaster their sleep was. But now they found this random doctor with a white coat and they prescribed this medication and now they're just sleeping great in this beautiful bed and big smiles on their face. And this was the post that I made on LinkedIn that basically let's look at the 2022 study that was, you know, cited by this drug company. So Mignot was the author, very, very, very accomplished sleep researcher out in Stanford. Basically said, number one, at 3 months, the 25 milligram dose of this drug reduced wakefulness after sleep onset by about 10 minutes. Number two, the time it took people to fall asleep was not significantly reduced with this drug at either time points compared to placebo. This is probably the reason why the Lemborexant webpage doesn't really show the Suvorexant, the Belsomra webpage doesn't really show sleep onset data because it's not good. It's making you fall asleep. This one is basically saying, look, we're not separated from placebo. So the person that comes to your clinic who says, I can't fall asleep at night, it takes me hours and hours and hours to fall asleep. Is this a drug we're reaching for here? And finally, even though there was a small and statistically significant improvement of total sleep time, IDSIQ sleepiness domain scores were not significantly improved compared to placebo. And that's important. We're going to get back to it. So the patient comes to you and you are a pro sleep aid drug. And you're basically saying, look, I don't have the capacity to do CBTI. I don't really like CBTI. I don't believe in it. I believe in it. I don't have the capacity, whatever. So I use sleeping pills. What do we tell our patients about them? Is this the conversation we're having? Because I do. Hey, look, if you want a sleeping pill, I can give you one, but this pill doesn't really statistically show any meaningful change in terms of the time it takes people to fall asleep. And it's probably only adding about 20, 25 minutes of sleep time. The complaint you're coming to me with seems very divergent from what we're talking about now. In fact, I'm going to guess if you're pro sleeping pill, this is the last conversation you want to have. Because you want somebody to believe in the pill, right? And I have had this conversation. I had this conversation with a pediatric residency director. He's like, we don't talk a lot about melatonin. We just give it and hope for the best. Of course, you're not going to sit there and tell us, well, here, give this to your child who can't sleep. There's probably not a lot of melatonin in it. In fact, there may be none in it or maybe three times the amount on the, we don't know, but here, just... The belief is the important part, right? I mean, these patients who come to see me, hey, Chris, I'm here because my primary care doctor won't write a sleeping pill for me anymore. And I really need that 5.6 minutes faster sleep onset. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, I can't sleep without it. So how do we scientifically rectify that? Or do we care? But to me, as I think about entering into a partnership with a patient, there's a certain level of honesty and transparency that needs to happen there, right? And I think that conversation we have with other, I'm getting ready to start a high blood pressure medication pill. You're getting ready to start a cholesterol lowering medication pill. I'm expecting that not only is this drug going to meaningfully reduce these parameters, my cholesterol, my blood pressure, my blood sugar, but I'm also expecting it to reduce it in a meaningful way, a way that improves my health. So let's for a minute say that all three of these medications are statistically, absolutely reducing the time it takes you to fall asleep by 5 or 10 minutes. There's no question. It's doing that beyond a placebo. And you're getting 20 extra minutes of sleep based upon what we're recording. Okay. The big question we haven't answered is that meaningful? Are we improving the lives and the health of patients, the performance, the longevity, the enjoyment of life beyond what you would have gotten without it? And there's no data to support that. And we know if we're looking at the parameter of keeping somebody asleep, there's a lot of ways you can do that that are very unhealthy. Increasing wakefulness after sleep onset. How much was in your diary, how many times did you wake up last night? I think we have to be very careful about that in the sense that somebody wakes up for 10 or 20 minutes, is this necessarily unhealthy? So I just find that when you look at 100 people who come to a clinic and say, I'm struggling with my sleep, I'm having difficulty with my sleep, I've been on pills, are we having the conversation about what these pills actually do? Are we pulling out the study? When you talk to somebody who's, God, unfortunately going through cancer therapy, they know this stuff. Hey, Chris, I just wanted to let you know, my wife, Linda, we just got some bad news. She's got stage 4, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, God, I'm so sorry. How can I help? Well, it's okay. I mean, we've talked about therapeutic options, and they're really feeling like 85 to 90% cure right here. So we're feeling pretty good about this. Like, that's part of the conversation. Are we having that conversation with sleeping pills? Hey, listen, I'm really sorry it's taking you 8 hours to fall asleep at night, and you're feeling like most nights you don't sleep at all. I mean, these are the patients that we're seeing, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. This is what I'm seeing. This is like the malignancy of insomnia, the anxiety, the stress, the fear. We've talked about in previous episodes, insomnia is a trauma. It's a PTSD phenomenon. I hear what you're saying, and what I've got, the newest agents that we have, I think we can improve you by 5 or 10 minutes. How is that going to go over in that conversation? Somebody who's morbidly obese, I've got an expensive drug for you that statistically is definitely going to drop your weight by 5 to 6 pounds. Okay, great. Is that meaningful to the patient who's so overweight they can't get out of bed? I think you'd have that conversation. Look, before you spend a lot of money on this drug, I just want to let you know, in most studies, it's only going to decrease your weight by about, I don't know, 3 to 5 pounds. If the patient says, hey, listen, that's at least a start. Okay, great. That's a clinical decision that you can make. So I think that I'm not anti-medication. I just, number one, when we look at work, do these pills work? We're kind of playing around with the definition here. Yes, statistically, they improve sleep parameters over a placebo. I believe that. Sure. And the studies show that. Is that meaningful, though? Is that meaningful to the patient and congruent to the complaint they've just given you? Chris, I need 20 more minutes extra sleep. Is that what they're telling you? Not what they're telling me. Not even close. Not even close. So then it becomes, what do these pills matter? Or does it matter? So somebody who's just saying, look, Mrs. Smith comes in, she's older, they work for her, she believes in them. How much should I be pushing back against that? I think that's a very interesting question. And maybe that's what is being asked here by Dr. Mims and another sleep doctor that will remain unnamed that we really got into this. You know, I'm like, look, if I don't want to fight about it, defend your position. Show me where I'm wrong here. Because to me, there's an element sometimes of not being completely transparent with a patient. Maybe you are. Maybe doctors are. Listen, this is only going to improve your sleep for 5 minutes. I don't care. I hear what you're saying, Chris, but it makes me sleep, so I want it. I mean, how much are we obliged to push back against this? Chris, I hear what you're saying about this lymphoma, but if I wrap a wet towel around my head, I really feel like it helps reduce my cancer burden. I mean, I don't know where does our input stop there, and we're allowed to let people believe, particularly in this day and age where science and doctors and research is very much under attack. So I will tell you how I personally move forward. I'm very transparent with patients. I'm not going to sit here and talk about a sleep aid doing more than what all the studies show. And I'm taking the best of the studies. This is back to the beginning of the title. I want to be wrong. I would love to see that pill that radically improves the quality of sleep so much that clear research shows these people are living longer, healthier lives because of their sleeping pill use. I'm waiting for that research. So listen, I'm a huge fan of CBTI. I'm a huge fan of people who believe in it. There is a place for sleeping pills. But I think that when you look at what sleeping pills actually do, like the best of the research, I'm leaving out the research that says it don't do anything, the best of the research, I still think might be inadequate for what the average individual brings to us. And I think it's important for patients to understand that. So I wish we had better therapies. I wish we had things to do. I wish every doctor had the time that we do to spend talking about insomnia, and there weren't language barriers and there weren't barriers to good care. But I don't see that case where I'm thinking, well, no CBTI for this person, no discussions about how sleep works and how insomnia works and how the pills you've been taking for 10 years work. I'm just going to blindly refill it and not engage in that conversation, because I think everybody deserves that. And so send me your best. I'd like to read them in future episodes. What am I missing here? I genuinely want to know, because if we're not, CBTI again sort of emerges as the victor here, that it's not about medically treating somebody who can't sleep. Once again, we're about readjusting and realigning and reimagining our relationship with sleep and putting it in a much healthier place. So that's it. Once again, I really thank Dr. Mims for engaging in the conversation. I like it. I like pushback. I think we all get better with pushback. We all learn with pushback. And I want to learn. I want to learn from the sleep pill devotees. Chris, you're actually missing the point with these things. It's not about their efficacy. It's not about X or Y, it's about Z. So if you got the Z, I am all ears. Communicate with the show, Dr. Chris Winner, Instagram, Dr. Chris Winner, Twitter, Dr. Chris Winner, TikTok. We have the Sleep Unplugged podcast page. You can find videos of our podcast on there. Look forward to coming to you from Indianapolis soon and giving you the update on what's hot in sleep. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. All the best to everyone out there, including Dr. Mims and all the great people who leave reviews for our podcast. Really appreciate it. Until next week, sleep well.